Chapter 5, Camp Meetings.
About 8 o'clock on Friday evening, we reached Boston. The next morning, we took the first train to Groveland. When we arrived at the campground, the rain was literally pouring. Elder Haskell had labored constantly up to this time, and excellent meetings were reported. There were 47 tents on the ground, besides 3 large tents, the one for the congregation being 80 by 125 feet in dimensions. The meetings on the Sabbath were of the deepest interest. The church was revived and strengthened, while sinners and backsliders were aroused to a sense of their danger. Sunday morning, the weather was still cloudy, but before it was time for the people to assemble, the sun shone forth. Boats and trains poured their living freight upon the ground in thousands. Elder Smith spoke in the morning upon the Eastern question. The subject was of special interest, and the people listened with the most earnest attention. In the afternoon, it was difficult to make my way to the desk through the standing crowd. Upon reaching it, a sea of heads was before me. The mammoth tent was full, and thousands stood outside, making a living wall several feet deep. My lungs and throat pained me very much. Yet I believed that God would help me upon this important occasion. While speaking, my weariness and pain were forgotten as I realized that I was speaking to a people that did not regard my words as idle tales. The discourse occupied over an hour, and the very best attention was given throughout. As the closing hymn was being sung, the officers of the Temperance Reform Club of Haverhill solicited me, as on the previous year, to speak before their association on Monday evening. Having an appointment to speak at Danvers, I was obliged to decline the invitation. Monday morning, we had a season of prayer in our tent in behalf of my husband. We presented his case to the great physician. It was a precious season. The peace of heaven rested upon us. These words came forcibly to my mind. This is the victory that overcometh the world, even our faith. We all felt the blessing of God resting upon us. We then assembled in the large tent. My husband met with us and spoke for a short time, uttering precious words from a heart softened and aglow with a deep sense of the mercy and goodness of God. He endeavored to make the believers in the truth realize that it is their privilege to receive the assurance of the grace of God in their hearts, and that the great truths we believe should sanctify the life, ennoble the character, and have a saving influence upon the world. The tearful eyes of the people showed that their hearts were touched and melted by these remarks. We then took up the work where we had left it on the Sabbath, and the morning was spent in special labor for sinners and backsliders, of whom 200 came forward for prayers, ranging in years from the child of 10 to gray-headed men and women. More than a score of these were setting their feet in the way of life for the first time. In the afternoon, 38 persons were baptized, and quite a number delayed baptism until they should return to their homes. Monday evening, in company with Elder Canwright and several others, I took the cars for Danvers. My husband was not able to accompany me. When released from the immediate pressure of the camp meeting, I realized that I was sick and had but little strength. Yet the cars were fast bearing us on to my appointment in Danvers. Here I must stand before entire strangers whose minds had been prejudiced by false reports and wicked slander. I thought that if I could have strength of lungs, clearness of voice, and freedom from pain of heart, I would be very grateful to God. These thoughts and feelings were kept to myself, and in great distress I silently called upon God. I was too weary to arrange my thoughts in connected words, but I felt that I must have help, and asked for it with my whole heart. physical and mental strength I must have if I spoke that night. I said over and over again in my silent prayer, I hang my helpless soul on Thee, O God, my Deliverer. Forsake me not in this, the hour of my need. As the time for meeting drew on, my spirit wrestled in an agony of prayer for strength and power from God. While the last hymn was being sung, I went to the stand. I stood up in great weakness, knowing that if any degree of success attended my labors, it would be through the strength of the Mighty One. The Spirit of the Lord rested upon me as I attempted to speak. Like a shock of electricity, I felt it upon my heart, and all pain was instantly removed. I had suffered great pain in the nerves centering in the brain. This also was entirely removed. My irritated throat and sore lungs were relieved. My left arm and hand had become nearly useless in consequence of pain in my heart, but natural feeling was now restored. My mind was clear. My soul was full of the light and love of God. Angels of God seemed to be on every side, like a wall of fire. The tent was full, and about 200 persons stood outside the canvas, unable to find room inside. I spoke from the words of Christ in answer to the question of the learned scribe as to which was the great commandment of the law. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. Matthew 22:37. The blessing of God rested upon me, and my pain and feebleness left me. Before me were a people whom I might not meet again until the judgment, and the desire for their salvation led me to speak earnestly and in the fear of God, that I might be free from their blood. Great freedom attended my effort, which occupied 1 hour and 10 minutes. Jesus was my helper, and His name shall have all the glory. The audience was very attentive. We returned to Groveland on Tuesday to find the camp breaking up, tents being struck, our brethren saying farewell and ready to step on board the cars to return to their homes. This was one of the best camp meetings I ever attended. Before leaving the ground, Elders Canwright and Haskell, my husband, Sister Ings, and I sought a retired place in the grove and united in prayer for the blessing of health and the grace of God to rest more abundantly upon my husband. We all deeply felt the need of my husband's help when so many urgent calls for preaching were coming in from every direction. This season of prayer was a very precious one, and the sweet peace and joy that settled upon us was our assurance that God heard our petitions. In the afternoon, Elder Haskell took us in his carriage, and we started for South Lancaster to rest at his home for a time. We preferred this way of traveling, thinking it would benefit our health. We had daily conflicts with the powers of darkness, but we did not yield our faith or become in the least discouraged. My husband, because of disease, was desponding, and Satan's temptations seemed to greatly disturb his mind. But we had no thought of being overcome by the enemy. No less than 3 times a day we presented his case to the great physician, who can heal both soul and body. Every season of prayer to us was very precious. On every occasion we had special manifestations of the light and love of God. While pleading with God in my husband's behalf one evening at Brother Haskell's, the Lord seemed to be among us in every deed. It was a season never to be forgotten. The room seemed to be lighted up with the presence of angels. We praised the Lord with our hearts and voices. One blind sister present said, "Is this a vision? Is this heaven?" Our hearts were in such close communion with God that we felt the hallowed hours too sacred to be slept away. We retired to rest, but nearly the entire night was passed in talking and meditating upon the goodness and love of God and in glorifying Him with rejoicing. We decided to travel by private conveyance a part of the way to the Vermont camp meeting, as we thought this would be beneficial to my husband. At noon, we would stop by the roadside, kindle a fire, prepare our lunch, and have a season of prayer. These precious hours spent in company with Brother and Sister Haskell, Sister Ings, and Sister Huntley will never be forgotten. Our prayers went up to God all the way from South Lancaster to Vermont. After traveling 3 days, we took the cars and thus completed our journey. This meeting was of special benefit to the cause in Vermont. The Lord gave me strength to speak to the people as often as once each day. I give the following from Elder Uriah Smith's account of the meeting published in the Review and Herald. Quote, Brother and Sister White and Brother Haskell were at this meeting to the great joy of the brethren. Sabbath, September 8, the day appointed as a fast day with especial reference to Brother White's state of health, was observed on the campground. It was a good day. There was freedom in prayer and good tokens that these prayers were not in vain. The blessing of the Lord was with His people in large measure. Sabbath afternoon, Sister White spoke with great freedom and effect. About 100 came forward for prayers, manifesting deep feeling and an earnest purpose to seek the Lord. Unquote. We went directly from Vermont to the New York camp meeting. The Lord gave me great freedom in speaking to the people, but some were not prepared to be benefited by the meeting. They failed to realize their condition and did not seek the Lord earnestly, confessing their backslidings and putting away their sins. One of the great objects of holding camp meetings is that our brethren may feel their danger of being overcharged with the cares of this life. A great loss is sustained when these privileges are not improved. We returned to Michigan and after a few days went to Lansing to attend the camp meeting there, which continued 2 weeks. Here I labored very earnestly and was sustained by the Spirit of the Lord. I was greatly blessed in speaking to the students and in laboring for their salvation. This was a remarkable meeting. The Spirit of God was present from the beginning to the close. As the result of this meeting, 130 were baptized. A large part of these were students from our college. We were rejoiced to see the salvation of God in this meeting. After spending a few weeks in Battle Creek, we decided to cross the plains to California.
Chapter 6. Labors in California.
My husband labored but little in California. His restoration seemed to be deferred. Our prayers ascended to heaven no less than 3 and sometimes 5 times a day, and the peace of God often rested upon us. I was not in the least discouraged. Not being able to sleep much nights, a large share of the time was spent in prayer and grateful praise to God for His mercies. I felt the peace of God ruling in my heart constantly, and could indeed say that my peace was as a river. Unforeseen and unexpected trials came upon me, which, in addition to my husband's sickness, nearly overwhelmed me. But my trust and confidence in God were unshaken. He was truly a present help in every time of need. We visited Healdsburg, St. Helena, Vacaville, and Pacheco. My husband accompanied me when the weather was favorable. The winter was rather a trying one to us, and as my husband had improved in health and the weather in Michigan had become mild, he returned to be treated at the sanitarium. Here he received great benefit and resumed writing for our papers with his usual clearness and force. I dared not accompany my husband across the plains, for constant care and anxiety and inability to sleep had brought upon me heart difficulties which were alarming. We felt keenly as the hour of separation drew on. It was impossible to restrain our tears, for we knew not that we should meet again in this world. My husband was returning to Michigan, and we had decided that it was advisable for me to visit Oregon and bear my testimony to those who had never heard me. I left Healdsburg for Oakland the 7th of June and met with the Oakland and San Francisco churches under the large tent in San Francisco, where Brother Healy had been laboring. I felt the burden of testimony and the great need of persevering personal efforts on the part of these churches to bring others to the knowledge of the truth. I had been shown that San Francisco and Oakland were missionary fields and ever would be. Their increase of numbers would be slow, but if all in these churches were living members and would do what they might do in getting the light before others, many more would be brought into the ranks and obey the truth. The present believers in the truth were not interested for the salvation of others as they should be. Inactivity and indolence in the cause of God would result in backsliding from God themselves, and by their example they would hinder others from going forward. Unselfish, persevering, active exertion would be productive of the very best results. I tried to impress upon them that which the Lord had presented before me, that He would have the truth presented to others by earnest, active laborers, not those who merely profess to believe it. They should not present the truth in words merely, but by a circumspect life, by being living representatives of the truth. I was shown that those who compose these churches should be Bible students, studying the will of God most earnestly that they may learn to be laborers in the cause of God. They should sow the seeds of truth wherever they might be, at home, in the workshop, in the market, as well as in the meeting house. In order to become familiar with the Bible, they should read it carefully and prayerfully. In order to cast themselves and their burden on Christ, they must begin at once to study to realize the value of the cross of Christ and learn to bear it. If they would live holy lives, they must now have the fear of God before them. It is trial that leads us to see what we are. It is the season of temptation that gives a glimpse of one's real character and shows the necessity for the cultivation of good traits. Trusting in the blessing of God, the Christian is safe anywhere. In the city he will not be corrupted. In the counting room he will be marked for his habits of strict integrity. In the mechanic's shop, every portion of his work will be done with fidelity, with an eye single to the glory of God. When this course is pursued by its individual members, a church will be successful. Prosperity will never attend these churches until the individual members shall be closely connected with God, having an unselfish interest in the salvation of their fellow men. Ministers may preach pleasing and forcible discourses, and much labor may be put forth to build up and make the church prosperous. But unless its individual members shall act their part as servants of Jesus Christ, the church will ever be in darkness and without strength. Hard and dark as the world is, the influence of a really consistent example will be a power for good. A person might as well expect a harvest where he has never sown, or knowledge where he has never sought for it, as to expect to be saved in indolence. An idler and a sluggard will never make a success in breaking down pride and overcoming the power of temptation to sinful indulgences, which keep him from his Savior. The light of truth, sanctifying the life, will discover to the receiver the sinful passions in his heart, which are striving for the mastery, making it necessary for him to stretch every nerve and exert all his powers to resist Satan, that he may conquer through the merits of Christ. When surrounded by influences calculated to lead away from God, His petitions may be unwearied for help and strength from Jesus, that he may overcome the devices of Satan. Some in these churches are in constant danger because the cares of this life and worldly thoughts so occupy the mind that they do not think upon God or heaven and the needs of their own souls. They rouse from their stupor now and then, but fall back again in deeper slumber. Unless they shall fully rouse from their slumbers, God will remove the light and blessings he has given them. He will in his anger remove the candlestick out of its place. He has made these churches the depository of his law. If they reject sin, and by active, earnest piety show stability and submission to the precepts of God's word, and are faithful in the discharge of religious duty, they will help to establish the candlestick in its place, and will have the evidence that the Lord of hosts is with them, and the God of Jacob is their refuge.
Chapter 7. Visit to Oregon.
Sunday, June 10, the day we were to start for Oregon, I was prostrated with heart disease. My friends thought it almost presumption for me to take the steamer, but I thought I should rest if I could get on board the boat. I arranged to do considerable writing during the passage. In company with a lady friend and Elder J. N. Loughborough, I left San Francisco on the afternoon of the 10th upon the steamer Oregon. Captain Connor, who had charge of this splendid steamer, was very attentive to his passengers. As we passed through the Golden Gate into the broad ocean, it was very rough. The wind was against us, and the steamer pitched fearfully, while the ocean was lashed into fury by the wind. I watched the clouded sky, the rushing waves leaping mountain high, and the spray reflecting the colors of the rainbow. The sight was fearfully grand, and I was filled with awe while contemplating the mysteries of the deep. It is terrible in its wrath. There is a fearful beauty in the lifting up of its proud waves with roaring, and then falling back in mournful sobs. I could see the exhibition of God's power in the movements of the restless waters, groaning beneath the action of the merciless winds, which tossed the waves up on high as if in convulsions of agony. We were in a beautiful boat, tossed at the mercy of the ever-restless waves, but there was an unseen power holding a steady grasp upon the waters. God alone has power to keep them within their appointed boundaries. He can hold the waters as in the hollow of his hand. The deep will obey the voice of its Creator. Hitherto shalt thou come, but no further. And here shall thy proud waves be stayed. What a subject for thought was the broad, grand Pacific Ocean! In appearance, it was the very opposite of Pacific. It was madness and fury. As we take a surface view of the water, nothing seems so utterly unmanageable, so completely without law or order as the great deep. But God's law is obeyed by the ocean. He balances the waters and marks their bed. As I looked at the heavens above and the waters beneath, I inquired, "Where am I? Where am I going? Nothing but the boundless waters around me. How many have thus embarked upon the waters and never again seen the green fields or their happy homes? They were dropped into the deep as a grain of sand, and thus ended their lives." As I looked upon the white-capped roaring billows, I was reminded of that scene in the life of Christ, when the disciples, in obedience to the command of their master, went in their boats to the farther side of the sea. A terrible tempest broke upon them. Their vessels would not obey their will, and they were driven hither and thither until they laid down their oars in despair. They expected to perish there. But while the tempest and the billows talked with death, Christ, whom they had left upon the other side, appeared to them, walking calmly upon the boisterous, white-capped waves. They had been bewildered by the uselessness of their efforts and the apparent hopelessness of their case, and had given up all for lost. When they saw Jesus before them upon the water, it increased their terror. They interpreted it as a sure precursor of their immediate death. They cried out in great fear. But instead of his appearance heralding the presence of death, he came as the messenger of life. His voice was heard above the roar of the elements. "It is I. Be not afraid." How quickly the scene now changed from the horror of despair to the joy of faith and hope in the presence of the beloved Master. The disciples felt no more anxiety nor dread of death, for Christ was with them. Shall we refuse obedience to the source of all power, whose law even the sea and the waves obey? Shall I fear to trust myself to the protection of him who has said that not a sparrow falleth to the ground without the notice of our Heavenly Father? When nearly all had left for their staterooms, I continued on deck. The captain had provided me a reclining cane chair and blankets to serve as a protection from the chilly air. I knew that if I went into the cabin, I should be sick. Night came on, darkness covered the sea, and the plunging waves were pitching our ship fearfully. This great vessel was as a mere chip upon the merciless waters, but she was guarded and protected on her course by the heavenly angels commissioned of God to do His bidding.